You're the only gay private eye in the Capital District, maybe in all of New York State.
Love is harder than crime.
Gay sex in the 70s.
Tell her I'm a friend, a nice Chinese girl.
Our mayor, this mayor of this city, has defied God's law.
Most Americans hate gay people.
Two worlds exist in this country. The quiet, conservative life and the life of those two men.
You gonna do this again next summer?
Well, maybe not.
Happy New Year and welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. In this week's second of our two traditional holiday season specials, award-winning entertainment reporter Steve Pride recalls some of the most memorable queer moments on big and small screens during the past 12 months, and they were plentiful. Our news wrap crew returns next week to bring us up to date on some of the news in or affecting the gay and lesbian community. But now it's time to dim the house lights for Pride on Screen 2005.
Hello, I'm Steve Pride, and welcome to a very special Pride on Screen. Sit back, relax, and butter your popcorn while we look at the best of gay and lesbian images on screens, both big and small, and pick the 10 best LGBT films of the year.
After my operation, I will be a woman.
Summer, I was 8 years old. 5 hours disappeared from my life.
The bottom line is, we're around each other, and this thing grabs hold of us again.
On the night of November 14th, two men broke into a quiet farmhouse in Kansas and murdered an entire family.
Before we get to my list of the top 10 films, let's start small. Besides inroads at the multiplex, this year, gay images and storylines on the small screen were almost too numerous to count, especially on over-the-air broadcast television.
Dude, what if your mom walks in?
She won't.
You don't know that. Just wait till everybody's asleep. Seriously, I'll make it worth your while.
You better.
That was Desperate Housewives, if you're keeping score. This year on cable, the gay-adjacent programming of Bravo and Lifetime was trumped by three gay-specific networks competing for the gay viewer's attention. Here, television expanded from satellite to cable pay-per-view and added original made-for-television fare that retooled well-worn genres. Dante's Cove had hunks in a haunted house, and Chad Allen was a gay detective in Third Man Out.
Look, Strachey, I need your help. You're the only gay private eye in the Capital District, maybe in all of New York State.
I see. You figured that would make me sympathetic to your case. Is that it?
Well, you figured wrong.
Cute Television moved into a state-of-the-art production facility in Burbank and started popping up on cable systems around the U.S. with a mix of talk shows, queer classic films, and news.
Welcome to the QT and World News on Planet Out. I'm Christopher Jones.
This summer, MTV Networks, the force behind channels like VH1, MTV, TV Land, and Spike TV, gave birth to the biggest cable channel ever for lesbians and gays, Logo.
This is CBS News on Logo. I'm Jason Bellini. All this week, we'll be looking back at the year 2005, from the battle over same-sex marriage to the growing trend of gay themes showing up on the silver screen.
I'm not sure they're silver anymore, but the big story on the big screen is similar to what we saw on television. While themes dealing with coming of age or coming out of the closet popped up in gems like My Summer of Love and Dorian Blues, they were largely supplanted by gay and lesbian projects working within familiar, well-worn mainstream genres. Val Kilmer's Gay Detective in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, or the lesbian spies of Debs. The latter propelled writer-director Angela Robinson from obscurity to a deal with Disney.
My name's Angela Robinson. The premise of Debs is that there's a secret test hidden in the SAT, and if you score particularly well on this test, then you're recruited by the government into a top-secret agency for girls.
Why is it I can hold the whole world hostage? I'm scared of going on one stupid blind date.
Because love is harder than crime.
There were a number of great comedies in 2005. Despite its name, Slutty Summer was low on budget but high on the benefits of commitment and love. Garçon Stupide, a coming-of-age story about a young gay man in Switzerland, was amusing, poignant, and boasted the hottest poster of the year. Red Doors from filmmaker Georgia Lee revolved around an Asian-American family that included a lesbian daughter. It's now being developed by CBS for a possible series. And in a similar vein, there was Saving Face, written and directed by Alice Wu.
I'd like to see your place. I have a pregnant mother at home. I'd like to meet her. Yeah, she's not ready. It's been weeks. Just tell her I'm a friend, a nice Chinese girl.
You're not just a nice Chinese girl.
I'll fake it.
You don't know my mom.
Exactly.
But I did promise you a list. So what are my picks for the 10 best gay films of 2005? It's a tough year to pick only 10, but for me, I think number 10 would be Coup de Gueule.
Olivier Ducastel.
And I'm Jacques Martineau. We are the directors, writers, but not the producers of Côte d'Azur.
Or Crustacé et Coquillage in French. It's Crustacean and Shellfish. Or Cockles and Mussels.
Well, it's a family movie.
The thing we can tell is that it's what we call a summer vacation movie, because we have very long summer vacation in France. People take between 3 weeks and 5 weeks in summer. And it's parents in their 40s and teenagers. And it's the way that they imagine the life of each other. The parents guessing that maybe their son is gay, and the teenager looking to their parents like they think maybe their life is a little bit boring. And in fact, the parents' life is quite exciting.
So it's a holiday movie, and it's all about sexuality and sexual identity.
نگران نباشید اگه یک مدتی از من خبر نداشته باشید. می بوسمتون قربان شما سیامک.
My pick for number 9 is a film released by Wolf Video that few people saw during its theatrical run. Luckily, they'll soon be releasing it on DVD. It's called Unveiled and is a stunningly beautiful portrait of a woman who is an illegal Iranian refugee cross-dressing as a man to hide in a small German town. Her situation becomes complicated and frightening when she falls in love with a local woman. Another film that crossed the politics of the Middle East with a German storyline came from the award-winning filmmaker behind Yossi and Jagger, Etienne Fox, who returned to the American multiplex with an Israeli drama about a hitman tracking down an ex-Nazi officer. Going undercover, he finds his prejudices challenged when he meets the man's openly gay grandson. At number 8, Walk on Water.
So they didn't circumcise you? I think I never saw one. You know, we used to talk about it in the army, if it looks bigger and if it's better in bed.
I don't know. It's the only one I ever had.
Israel is perceived as one of the world's more macho societies, so the rules of queer theory dictate that homophobia ought to be the norm. But it's a young country and one of many contradictions.
Israel is an amazing place because it's, on the one hand, it's very tough and closed and oppressed in many ways.
Director Eitan Fox.
But on the other hand, you have this amazing gay scene or gay life in Tel Aviv, and you have nightclubs and bars and my movies and other movies and television series that have gay characters in them. And we were first to have these characters before Americans had them even, you know. It's like, and so you say, how could this happen? It's full of contradictions and full of these dichotomies. On the one hand, you're these tough machos, and on the other hand, you're so open-minded and accepting towards gays. It's a crazy place, Israel.
There were great LGBT documentaries in 2005. I found Unexpected Suspense in Nicole Kahn's Little Man, which recounted the heart-wrenching story of her tiny son Nicholas, born an amazing 100 days premature. Pursuit of Equality focused on the gay marriage flap in San Francisco and Maverick Mayor Gavin Newsom.
Is because our mayor, this mayor of this city, has defied God's law.
This is Gavin Newsom, mayor of the city and county of San Francisco.
In his State of the Union address, President Bush said, "We must defend the sanctity of marriage." 23 days later, Mayor Gavin Newsom authorized San Francisco city officials to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples.
I guess I realized when I got into office that guys like me come and go, and sooner than we think. We're just pictures on a wall and a proclamation as we hand off the baton to someone else. And you got a moment in time, and you got an opportunity to advance something you believe in. Otherwise, you play in the margins, and you look back, and you start regretting. I'm not interested in dreaming of regretting. I want to try to do what I can to say what I'm saying privately in a public way.
But hands down, the best documentary of 2005 was my pick for number 7. Gay sex in the 70s. In this long overdue film, Joseph Lovett looked behind every bush, literally, in this fascinating memoir of the sexual explosive 12-year period between Stonewall and the onset of AIDS. It's hard now to imagine a world where casual sex was casual, when fear of a lethal sexually transmitted disease was unknown, and when being homosexual was more about endless sex than the right to marry.
I'm Joe Lovett. My film is Gay Sex in the 70s. I did the film for a number of reasons. I thought it was really important to really look at that time because it was really the forming of a gay community. And I had spent so much time in AIDS work, putting sex and AIDS together. I wanted to look at sex before AIDS and the development of sexual attitudes and sexual behavior and look at where it came from. Before 1969, gay people were separated not only from their own feelings, they were separated from one another and separated from the culture in which they lived. And after Stonewall, people came together. And it was a revolutionary period anyway, with all the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement and the women's movement. Life was changing fast, and individuals were getting together and changing the rules. And gay men and women started to do that as well.
My pick for number six is Loggerheads.
Do you know what the most amazing thing is? A female loggerhead who's born on this beach will return to this exact spot to lay her eggs.
How does she know?
It's a mystery, but something pulls her back.
When birth mothers like yourself try to find relinquished children, it can be very disruptive to the adoptive family. A closed adoption protects them.
Protects them from what?
From you.
The moving, lyrical film Loggerheads from writer-director Tim Kirkman tells the story of an adoption triad: birth mother, child, and adoptive parents. The three interwoven stories take place in the days leading up to a Mother's Day weekend, but in three distinct geographical regions of North Carolina, and possibly in three different years. In Asheville, Grace, an airport car rental agent, quits her job and embarks on a quest to find the son she gave up for adoption when she was just a teenager. Across the state in Cure Beach, a young man named Mark, obsessed with saving loggerhead sea turtles, meets George, a lonely motel owner, who offers him love and a place to stay as he battles AIDS. In the heart of the state, in the small town of Eden, a minister's wife struggles to confront her conservative husband over their estrangement from their adoptive son. According to writer-director Tim Kirkman, the film was inspired by true events.
Patsy and Eloise, the magic ladies from Dear Jesse, magic is mothers against Jesse in Congress. They were a political action group that was set up to try to help defeat Jesse Helms during the 1996 election. They called me and said, "We've just met someone that you need to meet. And it's this woman who had this great story about having given up a child for adoption and then her search for him through the North Carolina adoption system and the barriers that she faced in trying to do that." So as I got to know her, she shared with me not only her life, but his life. She shared with me his diaries, his writing, his photographs. His life was sort of open to me on the page. And I thought, this is a fantastic story. It needs to be told. I mean, this is a story of two people, two adults, who really wanted to meet and weren't allowed to meet.
At number five, another film set in the pre-cocktail era of AIDS. The Dying Gull is a psychological thriller based on the Craig Lucas play of the same name. Part Sunset Boulevard, part Greek tragedy, it's a tale of lust, power, corruption, betrayal, and revenge. Robert, played by Peter Sarsgaard, is a screenwriter who's written a film based on his lover's death from AIDS. Studio executive Jeffrey, played by Campbell Scott, loves the script but has a theory.
Most Americans hate gay people. They hear it's about gay people, they won't go.
What about Philadelphia?
Philadelphia is a movie about a man who hates gay people.
While this is the directorial debut for out gay playwright and screenwriter Craig Lucas, he's not new to Hollywood, having written Longtime Companion, Prelude to a Kiss, and The Secret Lives of Dentist. But in all his dealings with the movie biz, Lucas never had to make the Faustian bargain he presents in The Dying Gull.
I have to say that most of the movie is invented. I know the world a little bit. I worked out here a little bit, not very much. Nobody ever asked me to de-gay a script, and certainly no ostensibly straight producer ever came on to me. Most of the producers that approached me about projects out here were already gay, and they were out. So, you know, you make up a story, but for a story to work, there have to be problems.
This is Gavin Newsom, mayor of San Francisco, the most diverse and welcoming city in the world. And you're listening to Pride on Screen on This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine.
My pick for film number 4 comes from the director that, some say, invented the queer cinema new wave of the early 90s. Mysterious Skin is about pedophilia, hustlers, aliens, sadists, and the dark side of childhood. It's based on the Scott Heim novel of the same name.
Summer, I was 8 years old. 5 hours disappeared from my life. 5 hours. Lost. Gone without a trace.
Hello, this is Greg Araki, director of the film Mysterious Skin. I read the book in 1995 when it was first published, and it just had such a huge impact on me. I just loved it. It was such an important story, but such a heartfelt story and so sincere and just so emotional. It really just kind of devastated me when I read it, and it stayed with me for years afterwards. And so I knew that if I ever did make a film out of a book, this would be the book that I would want to do.
There were several movies this year that touched on perceptions of gender. Besides The Sublime Unveiled, Neil Jordan's uneven adaptation of novelist Pat McCabe's Breakfast on Pluto featured Cillian Murphy as a flamboyant crossdresser. And the best part of the disappointing movie version of Rent was Wilson Germain Herrera's performance as the drag queen Angel. That brings me to the number 3 film on my list, Transamerica.
Medical procedures to date.
The usual electrolysis, 3 years of hormone therapy, and a facial feminization surgery. After my operation, I will be a woman.
In Transamerica, a preoperative male-to-female transsexual takes an unexpected journey when she learns that she fathered a son, now a teenage runaway hustling on the streets of New York. Prior to her pending surgery, Bree travels to New York City to bail out the teenage Toby.
Me, Toby Wilkins.
Jesus the Reformer.
That's one of these churches that sends missionaries out.
No, I'm from the Church of the Potential Father.
Felicity Huffman is amazing as Bree. There are not a lot of positive portrayals of transsexuals on film, so Huffman was determined to get it right.
I worked with a woman who coaches men who are becoming women. I watched her coaching a transgendered woman, first of all, and then she coached me. So she did her regular style of teaching, and how I learned was as if I didn't know anything. So when she said, look, when women speak, they use their hands a lot. Men don't. When women speak, they give long and verbose answers, which I am an example of right now. And men usually, you know, go, yes, no. Well, it was hard. Women nod. Women go along in the conversation. They bring you along. Men don't. So I learned it as if I didn't know anything.
Although my number 2 pick takes place during a single period in Truman Capote's biography, the 5.5 years during which he researched and wrote his 1966 classic, In Cold Blood, the film Capote delivers the sum of the man.
On the night of November 14th, 2 men broke into a quiet farmhouse in Kansas and murdered an entire family. And why did they do that? 2 worlds exist in this country. The quiet conservative life and the life of those 2 men with the underbelly, the criminally violent. And those worlds converged that bloody night.
In this dazzling film, Philip Seymour Hoffman is amazing in the title role. But the prolific character actor does not immediately spring to mind when you think of Truman Capote, and he agrees.
They came to my house with the script, Danny and Bennett, who I've known since I was in high school. I didn't go to high school with them, but I met them in the summer program then. And before that time, I'd never thought about it at all. I mean, literally, I probably was thinking about napping or something. And they came to my house and said, hey, we have the script. Do you want to play Truman Capote? And I was like, I thought, first of all, that's absurd. And it really was. It was kind of like, well, that doesn't really. I mean, that was my reaction. It wasn't like, oh, yay, I get to, you know, it was like, what do you mean? You know, because of my image of Truman Capote in my head didn't really fit me.
A Google search of the phrase Brokeback Mountain returns over 10 million hits. It's the whispered favorite of a truckload of movie awards. It's a cowboy movie. It's not a cowboy movie. But no matter what your opinion of this wrenching love story, there's no denying its importance. Based on a short story by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Annie Proulx, the film version of Brokeback Mountain was directed by Academy Award-winning filmmaker Ang Lee from a screenplay by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Larry McMultrie
and his longtime writing partner, Diana Asana. It's not just a landmark gay film. It's one of the most heart-wrenching love stories that I've ever seen. Set against the sweeping vistas of Wyoming and Texas, the film tells the story of two young men, a ranch hand and a rodeo cowboy, who meet in the summer of 1963 when they work as sheep herders up on Brokeback Mountain. Ennis Del Mar, played by Heath Ledger, and Jack Twist, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, become friends and then unexpectedly lovers. But at summer's end, the two must come down from Brokeback and part ways.
You gonna do this again next summer?
Well, maybe not. Like I said, me and Alan was getting married in November. So, we're trying to get something on the ranch, I guess. And you?
Might go up to my daddy's place and give him a hand through the winter. I might be back. The army don't get me.
Well, I guess I'll see you around, huh?
Right.
Filmmaker Ang Lee is heterosexual, grew up in Taiwan, and was only 9 years old in 1963. So what drew him to this particular story?
Gay ranch hands in Wyoming, they're very far from me. But I think it touched that enigmatic subject of love, I think. And because the strange combination of West, macho Western and a gay love story, somehow. I think the unfamiliarity for me reach out very far in that mystery. And the emotion lands very hard, but the emotion is about missing, about something you don't get. I think that's very poignant, very profound. It's kind of existential to think that two characters spend 20 years trying to go back to where they started in the mountain, in a place that they hardly understand themselves. So that's a calling for me.
Remaining in Wyoming, Ennis does wed his sweetheart Alma, has two daughters, and struggles to eke out a living. Jack, in Texas, catches the eye of a wealthy rodeo queen, gets a job working for her father, they have a son. 4 years pass. One day, Ennis gets a postcard from Jack, who's en route to visit from Wyoming. When Jack arrives, it's clear that the passage of time has only strengthened their feelings. In the years that follow, Ennis and Jack meet up several times annually. They struggle to keep their bond alive and secret from their wives.
You still go fishing with Jack Twist?
Not often.
I used to wonder how come you never brought any trouts home. You always said you caught plenty, and you know how me and the girls lack fish. So one night I got your creel case open, not before you went on one of your little trips. Price tag still on it after 5 years. And I tied a note to the end of the line. It said, "Hello, Ennis, bring some fish home. Love, Alma." And then you come back looking all perky. I said you caught a bunch of browns and you ate them up. Do you remember? I looked in that case first chance I got, and there was my note still tied there. That line hadn't touched water in its life.
It mean nothing, Alma.
Don't try and fool me no more, Ennis. I know what it means. Jack Twist. Jack Nasty. You didn't go up there to fish.
Ennis Del Mar's inability to move beyond the boundaries of expectations, dictated by time and community, brings tear-inducing poignancy to Brokeback Mountain. Actor Heath Ledger stuns in the stoic role. Despite Ennis's taciturn nature, Ledger says he found things he admired in the man he played.
His potential, you know, he had great potential to love. And I think the one time you really see the potential is with his kids, his children, because that's the one form of love he's really allowed to express. It's not dangerous to him. And with his wife, it just wasn't really love. It was what he thought should be love. And it was a routine that he slipped into because it was conventional, it was traditional. And obviously his love for Jack was forbidden, and he hated himself for it. He punished himself for it, you know. Essentially, he was a homophobic man in love with another man.
A lot has been written about the courage of straight actors to play these gay roles. But according to Jake Gyllenhaal, who plays Jack...
You know, what I think is really more courageous is people who are trying to be intimate in their real life and who are up against the real things. I think it's a time where more people are open to this than it might seem.
The message of Brokeback Mountain isn't progressive or new. Men finding it impossible to live with the sexual and emotional feelings they have for each other is a common theme in gay film. But Brokeback Mountain is different in a critical way. The integrity of that love is never questioned. Director Ang Lee affirms the feelings the two men have for each other as natural, deeply held, and undeniable, even if the men suffer because of that. That is the film's real breakthrough achievement. Also important is that Brokeback Mountain works against preconceptions and stereotypes. In a year that brought us the creepy loner gay guy in The Wedding Crashers and the over-the-top effeminate gay men in The Producers, that's a good thing. To recap, my picks for the top 10 LGBT films of the year were number 10, Coup de Jet, number 9, Unveiled, number 8, Walk on Water, number 7, Gay Sex in the 70s, number 6, Loggerheads, number 5, The Dying Gull, number 4, Mysterious Skin, number 3, Transamerica, number 2, Capote, and hands down number 1, Brokeback Mountain. My top 10 picks may not match yours, but the great thing about 2005 is that there was a lot of pride on screen for you to choose from. For more information on the films I've mentioned or other queer films, drop by prideonscreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Every actor worth his salt strives to be honest and true in his portrayals on the stage or screen. Hello, this is Ian McKellen, and that's exactly what this program does as well. Join Greg and Lucia each week for This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine, right here on this station.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. This week, Steve Pride brought us Pride on Screen 2005, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to find out how you can help keep us on the air and own CDs of this and other keepsake programs as our thanks. To sign up for our weekly emailed program information messages and or our monthly This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For our associate producer, Lucia Chappell, and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Happy New Year, and thanks for listening on CJSF, Burnaby, British Columbia, WRIR, Richmond, Virginia, KUCR, Riverside, California, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Resolve to stay tuned.